Today is Wednesday. It's November 16th, 2022, and it's 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast on WGN Radio on Saturday nights. And you can always hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can listen to my podcast, America's Talking.
I'm Mark Jacob, a former Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the newly respectful proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel online newsletter.
You ask him, Austin.
I don't. Newly respectful. Is that Trump?
I'm respectful of John Williams and his podcast organization, and I've been hijacking his podcast for 6 years now with my adjectives, and I feel like I should just let him run the show the way he does and not try to derail him. So I'm, at least for today, I'm going to be respectful of John's prerogatives.
Although that in itself was disrespectful and derailing the podcast as I would have normally started it.
I know. The irony is just fabulous, isn't it?
And yet, I'm surprised you even feel that way, Eric. Did you get some hate mail or something since we spoke last?
I never get hate mail.
What's this
anymore,
comeuppance John? Of yours? I don't think I do get hate mail about you, if you haven't. And but we always appreciate your asides wherever they pop up in the podcast.
Well, then I will shelve my respect and continue trying to.
So. And Mark, it's nice to have you join our little panel again. And we specifically wanted you on this week because you were such an integral part of last week's podcast, as we talked about the election return right after Tuesday's voting. And since then, we have learned that the Senate is going to again be a Democrat chamber. It'll either be 50-50 or 51-49. But with the vice president voting, the Democrats maintain control of the Senate. And as we sit here now, the House is 217 red, 207 blue. Meanwhile, a Florida man made an announcement last night, as the New York Post put it. I don't know if you guys saw that, but at the bottom of their front page, Florida man makes announcement, details on page 26, and then on page 26, a very funny summary of what he said that night. To no one's surprise, Donald Trump announced that he's running for a third time, and to no one's surprise, his announcement was filled with grievances and falsehoods and the assertion that the last election was stolen. He even said that the vast majority of his endorsed candidates won. I forgot what it was like to listen to him because you go, no, wait, am I wrong? Because you go down that rabbit hole and you never come back. And we were in that thing for like 5 years.
Right.
And we haven't been for two. And I forgot how refreshing it is to not have to sort of mind check every single word that's coming out of someone's mouth. Anyway, he said that he will immediately demand, if he is elected, voter ID same-day paper ballots, which I think would negate the way he has always voted.
And you're going to have same-day paper ballots, but you're going to have the election decided that night. So
right.
Explain how that's going to happen. You know, he also wants to execute drug dealers, you know, so that's another new idea, new old idea.
Yeah.
John, the thing about listening to him live like that is a real reminder of why it's a bad thing to listen to him live, because when you're fact checking the thing he said, then you're going to miss the thing that another lie, and then you're trying to catch up to the third lie, and then you're back 45 minutes ago when he lied, and you cannot. Fact-checking cannot keep up with his level of lying.
It's a problem that debate moderators or interviewers run into with him, because he'll almost throw you off your game. You go, oh, wait, really? Because I thought pretty much everybody you endorsed lost, and now you've lost control of that part of the interview, right? Now your brain's over there. Should I stop this and go down that road? What number is he using? Do I waste the time on that? So if you just keep the hits coming, you kind of get away with it. And that's what he did for 4 years.
There was a really good National Review, the conservative publication that published the sort of seminal Never Trump essay when he announced in the primary. And it was a one-word editorial title. And the headline was "No, period."
Really?
And the first sentence is very good. They said, to paraphrase Voltaire after he attended an orgy, once was an experiment, twice would be perverse. And I think that there is a very, to your point on a lot of his endorsed candidates losing, some of it may be due to Trump, but a lot of it I think has to do with something you just mentioned, which is this obsession with fomenting a theory that early voting and mail-in voting is fraudulent. And that really, really hurt the GOP in a lot of races. A lot of people want to vote early. A lot of people want to go to the in-person early. A lot of people want to do vote by mail, Republican and Democrat. And when you're telling Republican voters that that method of voting is rigged, a lot of people don't use it. And then, hey, it rains on election day and I don't end up voting. And it really ends up hurting a lot of GOP candidates. We saw, in Illinois and many other states, you see Democrats really, and this has been this way for a long time, but it's become more prominent as early voting and mail-in voting have become more prominent. But the splits, the partisan splits in terms of the method of voting are really, really severe. So unless the GOP can, and other hard right sort of Republican figures, like a Charlie Kirk type of a person, were saying this is a big problem for Republicans if they don't make it okay for their own constituencies to not vote on election day and to vote early.
Well, and it's also a question in my mind, how much power would the president or even the federal government have in regulating how state elections are held? I mean, one of the primary arguments these days is that secretaries of state and these other officials at the local level have a lot of power as to whether they can curtail, say, Saturday voting as they're curtailing in Georgia. And it seems to me like our tradition, for better or worse, has been that elections are managed on the state level and even at the local level. And I don't know what a president, especially one that is almost certainly not going to have super majorities in the Senate or the House, is going to be able to do about that.
That's why I went back and listened to exactly how we put that.
We will do whatever it takes to bring back honesty, confidence, and trust in our elections. To eliminate cheating, I will immediately demand voter ID, same-day voting, and only paper ballots. Only paper ballots.
He said he would immediately demand. It wouldn't be an edict, but he will immediately demand, which is inconsequential. You can demand ice cream every night, and if you don't get it, you don't get it.
There's this idea that all the votes should be decided that night, which I think is wacky. And I mean, where was that written in the law that you had to, that you just stopped vote counting at midnight, or that we got? I mean, in as close as elections are in this country right now, that you would have everything decided. And in fact, as election count goes, like in Arizona and Nevada, there were a lot of eyes on that. The idea that those elections would be more prone to fraud because their vote count is slow doesn't really stand up to reason. I mean, they're every day they're coming out and saying we're counting this many votes, they came from this place, and then they're doing it. It seems like that would increase trust unless you have dishonest motives in viewing the whole thing, which is what the Republicans have right now.
Well, and you look at Florida, where they do count votes early, and they're able to give you solid results on election night. And Florida, of course, had to revamp its whole election process after the year 2000 debacle. And that works out pretty well. I don't really care for this extended counting that you're seeing in Arizona and Nevada. I think that is distracting to people, and it really helps if you can have all those early votes, those mail-in votes, counted as much as possible. So I think the kind of thing that Trump is suggesting, that you don't touch these ballots, everyone has to vote by the paper ballots on that day, was going to really slow down the count ultimately, because you're always going to have absentee voting, you're always going to have things like that. So
that's interesting, military, Eric. I've never understood why they wait to count those ballots. It just gives a Carrie Lake more oxygen. It just gives her more time to foment distrust.
Well, in Pennsylvania, that was the Republicans that prohibited them from counting those things early, so, and then they were complaining about how long the vote count takes. I mean, so it's a little bit of a kind of a scam argument, in my opinion.
I think there's probably some case to be made for some kind of federal guidelines in terms of what timing and things like this, because in theory, there's a point at which, for example, take early voting. There's a point at which, say, if you're allowed to vote 2 months early, like there's some actual concerns with doing that. I mean, you saw lots of things change in, the Pennsylvania Senate race is a good example. Very late in the game, people have already voted. Some major consequential things happened. So I think there is a case to be made for that. It's not from the fraud angle, but just from a pure, you know, efficiency of elections.
I would have no problem if they were to have some sort of a federal standards about, as long as they're fairly loose. I mean, I would think that, like, if you get 2 weeks of early voting plus weekends, if those were included, if you could have standards on absentee voting, whether you can vote absentee without an excuse, standards for when mail-in votes are due. Sometimes that you have to be this, the mail-in votes have to be there by election day. Sometimes they have to be postmarked by election day. And it seems like you would want as much as possible to standardize federal elections anyway. And then if you did that, it would probably end up standardizing most of the local elections as well, because people just want to get used to a certain system. I would have no problem with that, but it seems like everybody feels like they want to run things their own way. And again, I want to go back to this thing in Georgia where they decided they're not going to allow Saturday voting because it was the day after Robert E. Lee Day or something. There was some incredibly bizarre reason why Georgia is not going to allow Saturday voting. And that's just wrong. They're just trying to suppress the vote, period. Mm-hmm. I don't that just seems offensive to the whole idea of elections and democracy.
Well, now, shouldn't they just make Election Day a national holiday? I mean, shouldn't they do so many things? And shouldn't they have same-day registration everywhere? I mean, why couldn't – there are several simple steps they could do to – that would simply have the result of encouraging more people to vote. The real truth is that there are a lot of politicians who don't want more people to vote. And that's why they stand in the way of, you know, common sense moves like that.
Right. But I think that a version of those who don't want same day registration really do worry about the integrity of the election. And if we let people register that same day, we don't have enough time to vet them, or shenanigans are more easily, you know, that happens. So but I like you, Mark, think that if you are coming up with regulations about how you vote in the name of rigging the vote to your advantage, that's like, hell, that's like gerrymandering for that matter.
Right.
You know, it's just rigging the system so that you win and not trying to find what the real hope is from the electorate. You're rigging the vote. By the way, get a load of this. This is from the Economist YouGov poll from November 13th to November 15th. On that, though, 37% said that fraudulent postal voting either absolutely or most likely occurred. 37% of the people in a Economist YouGov poll felt that fraudulent postal voting either absolutely or almost certainly occurred. 42% said people voted who weren't legally allowed to vote. 42% said that absolutely happened or almost certainly happened. I guess define people. Maybe some folks got through, but was it, you know, defining? I doubt it. But 37% think that fraudulent postal voting occurred. Does that mean one person, or, you know, was it problematic? Those numbers maybe suggest that just hammering away at they cheated, they cheated, they cheated is getting through. Austin, how do you interpret those numbers, assuming that they're accurate?
We were kind of in, I think I mentioned this maybe on a previous podcast, we were in maybe from the 1950s to Trump, kind of an unique era in American history where the result of every election wasn't everyone saying the other side committed ballot fraud and cheated. That was the norm with every election, and they were really, really close oftentimes. So I don't think this is anything new. I think most people agree that it should be easy to vote and hard to cheat. So we should align on some basic things that people agree on for some ground rules for elections. And voter ID is one that cuts across party lines and demographics. People do generally support some form of voter ID laws. But this idea that it's always the debate of, yes, of course, like any system with millions and tens of billions participating, people participating on a single day, there's going to be errors and there's going to be fraud. But it's a question of what is the actual magnitude of that? And does it actually make a difference?
I don't
think who are the good faith actors trying to reduce it?
I don't think there's ever been a study of any sort that has detected significant voting fraud in the U.S.
It made a difference.
You're always going to find somebody who wasn't registered, who was allowed to vote, or who voted twice or whatever. But that these numbers are, you know, infinitesimally small, and you're not going to see them affecting any. I don't believe there's any race that's ever been governed by that, except maybe, you know, you might go back to the 1960 presidential election, where it seems quite possible for, well, Mark, you know the Chicago history way better than I do. Is it established that old man Daley stole the Illinois
vote? It's pretty much agreed upon that there were shenanigans there. Now, one thing that people get wrong all the time is that it didn't really matter whether Kennedy won Illinois or not.
Ah, okay.
It turned out that Texas was very close, and for a while they thought Illinois would be decisive, but Texas went for Kennedy enough to where he could afford to lose Illinois, as it turned out. But yeah, it seems like, I mean, at least from what the history is I've read, that there were, you know, those funny stuff going on. I mean, it was the Daley machine at the height of the Daley machine. Sure, they were going to do whatever they could get away with. The thing about that whole thing of, you know, dead people voting in Chicago is such a, you know, it's a myth. It's something that people still cite. And, you know, as somebody who was, you know, on the Metro desk, you know, for a long time at the Tribune, you know, every election we would look for that. We would look real carefully for that. We'd be have our, you know, really have our, you know, ears and eyes out trying to, you know, go to any situation where there was funny stuff going on. And it just wasn't. I mean, we almost never found any problems other than some poll workers sleeping and not opening the polling place on time. You know, by half an hour, that kind of stuff. But as far as, you know, rampant cheating, we're talking about, this is Chicago, which a lot of people think is just an example of, you know, political corruption and where nasty things happen. And I'm telling you, it wasn't happening in Chicago. It hasn't happened in Chicago for decades.
And the people fomenting sort of the more kooky conspiracy theories about dead people voting in Chicago, there's a wide open, blatant voter suppression effort in Chicago that's been here for years, and it's the seasonality of voting. We vote in February, the only big city that does our elections in February. It's a total incumbent protection program, because the most motivated special interests will get their people out to vote when it's really crummy weather outside, like it is today. And that's blatant. It's right out in the open.
Right.
And we're going to see again in this municipal election, this mayoral election come up, you know, 20% voter turnout, maybe. In Chicago, in places like California, if you have voter turnout that's that low in a municipal election, it automatically gets put in a November presidential year election. That's what your next municipal election is. So if people want more voting, more participation in Chicago, they have to change when people vote.
Yeah, I don't know what the history of that is. I have no idea why elections in Chicago are held that way. But you're totally right. I mean, it's a discouragement of people from voting. And I also don't quite understand why they can't hold elections on even years, you know, just to save money. It seems like, you know, what is it, because the mayoral race in Chicago is such a sideshow that we don't want any competing circus acts going on at the same time?
When do other cities around the major cities around the country, when do they hold their mayoral elections?
A lot of them do it. I have a graph that I should pull up. I believe a lot of them do it in Novembers of off years. So Novembers of non-presidential years. A couple of them do presidential years. And the reason that it's not the same as presidential is the theory is like, people are just getting out to vote for president and they're not really considering these municipal races, and we're going to get less educated votes on municipal races, whatever. we can have that debate. But the point is we are purposefully holding elections when people aren't used to voting or didn't grow up voting that way. Right. And it's not just Chicago. It's that, you know, every municipal race in Illinois has this weird timing. And there's been great studies on the effects of seasonality in voting, and it absolutely has a very large effect on turnout.
If you remember, we did push our primary back in 2008 in order to help Barack Obama when he was running the presidential primary. So it can be done.
Well, what has greater cachet, being a member of Congress or being the mayor of Chicago? Chuy Garcia is already a congressman. He'd rather be mayor of Chicago. Another question would be, what's a bigger headache? That neither of them pay that well, or one doesn't pay that much more than the other. If it was ego, what's better, being a member of the United States Congress or the mayor of the hellhole that is Chicago?
I vote for Chicago mayor as being kind of the, you know, more prominent, you know, the thing you'd have more bragging rights on. And, you know, if you're like a freshman congressman, you know, you're barely visible.
Well, and especially if you're a Democratic congressman in a Republican-controlled U.S. House, you don't have a lot of power. Your vote, your bills are not going to get through. But it is a much easier job. I think that's why Mike Quigley, who until recently was my congressman up here in the Northwest Side, decided he was just going to stay a congressman. Like, who wouldn't like to be a congressman? You get some grief from your constituents about airport noise and things like that. But in terms of the headaches, right. I always wonder who the heck would want to be mayor of Chicago. It seems like such an incredibly difficult job. But
you know who really wants to be mayor of Chicago? Willie Wilson. That guy is spending money on our station still. I mean, nobody else. Is anybody else running ads? Lori Lightfoot's got an online campaign that doesn't look real expensive. But Willie Wilson is dropping coin left all the time. He has for months, and he's got three, four more months to go.
I see Willie Wilson billboards still all over the city.
That's amazing.
I mean, yeah, he will command, a pretty decent share of the black vote. But you look at voter turnout. Black voter turnout for this election in Illinois and Chicago was significantly down, very, very far down. So that does not bode well for a candidate like him.
I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in the election. First of all, we don't really know who's going to be in the race until the candidate filing deadline for the petitions is the Monday after Thanksgiving. And I don't know how long it's going to take to process those petitions, but I'm guessing that by that time, a bunch of these real also-ran candidates will have dropped out, won't even turn in their petitions. We don't know what the field's going to be like. It looks like Brandon Johnson he works for CTU. He's a Cook County commissioner. He's getting a lot of labor endorsements early on. The labor jumped to back him before Chuy Garcia got in, and they're trying to occupy the same lane. And it seems to me like if you chop up that progressive vote finally enough, you might end up giving a guy like Willie Wilson a big enough lane to run in that he could make the runoff. It's not inconceivable.
Make the runoff, Willie Wilson?
Inconceivable, I don't think. Given how many candidates there might be in the field and where they're trying to position themselves, it might be. I mean, he's reliably gotten about 10% of the vote. And 10% doesn't sound like much, but if you got a 12-candidate field, it could be enough to get into a runoff.
But runoff meaning you're the first or second highest vote getter, right? Wow.
And no vote getter reached 50% plus one.
I'm looking at my producer, Pete, because you showed me yesterday, didn't you, Pete, what the latest polling is on the mayoral candidates, and Chuy Garcia, other than the mayor herself, was far and away number one. But Johnson and Wilson were like 2 and 5 or something, 2 and 4.
I think that Garcia poll may have been done by the Garcia campaign. I'm not sure who did that poll.
And here's the real problem we have with polling these days is that supposedly objective news media, like the big newspapers, etc., are doing less and less polling. And so you're not getting the same level of objective polling. You're getting the thing that drives me nuts is when some campaign does polling, and then if they like the results, they release it to some member of the news media who reports on it. And I mean, a poll by a campaign is not credible because they're not going to give you information that they don't like. And you don't even know how they asked the question or whether that was done, straightforwardly. And it could have been a push poll where they're trying to influence the people they're calling. I mean, those kind of campaign polls should just be, I mean, they should be ignored. They shouldn't be reported, but they constantly are just because that's what the news media does.
And Pete just reminded me that the poll was our News Click, which is completely unscientific, but it's kind of a top of mind poll.
We'll go with it, John. We'll go with it.
I usually do say that when I say this is an unscientific poll. It's a conversation starter. A lot of time it does reflect what the general consensus is, and obviously Chuy is top of mind.
And let's remember that even a highly scientific poll taken at this stage of the campaign is probably based on name recognition. That if someone like Brandon Johnson, who most people haven't heard of, gets enough money, gets enough donations, gets enough support, gets his message on the air, his platform will get more attention, and he's likely to rise in the polls. Now, whether he's going to win, I don't know. But I think right now we can all talk about who's in the race and who's likely to be on the ballot in February. But right now it's really early to talk about what polling might show. I do think that Mayor Lightfoot is probably a favorite to make the runoff, but I don't know.
Seriously, didn't she win every single precinct?
She won every ward.
Every ward, yeah.
She won every ward. But, I mean, you can't underestimate Tony Preckwinkle. That was right in the Ed Burke scandal, and everyone was talking about political corruption in Illinois. So she got a huge boost just from being a person who announced before Emanuel announced that he was not going to run, and the fact that she was calling everyone out for corruption and the greatest, you know, surprise dropped in her lap of Ed Burke being indicted. But I think the point is correct.
Yeah,
bring in the light. So the point is correct that in a really crowded field like this, you have to look at the people who have a floor of support. I think Willie Wilson has that. Lori Lightfoot has some of that. Brandon Johnson has that because he's being backed by the CTU, and that is, you know, 20,000, 25,000 members strong.
And SEIU.
And you have to seriously look at Vallis with police and fire. So those, I think, are the leading candidates. Now, it's a question tomorrow if Pat Quinn is going to announce he's in the race. He said he's announcing something related to politics. But with Pat Quinn, that could be anything. That could be a ballot initiative, or it could be he's endorsing someone, or he could be running.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, new bird.
Boy, I can't imagine that Pat Quinn is going to really – I mean, is he really a candidate for this decade? I mean, I'm sorry. I just
or
think that
city.
I think he worked himself through jobs, and, you know, he had his shot at, you know, at governor, and he's just on the, you know, the downward side of the curve. I can't believe that he will decide to run for mayor or how far he'll get. It just doesn't seem, I just don't see where his votes are and where his enthusiasm is.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's an excellent point. And who does he appeal to exactly? That's, you know, it's unclear. He doesn't, because I think that Austin's right to talk about Vallis being sort of the police and fire. Vallis made the conservative support, such as it is in Chicago, which is not huge, but it doesn't have to be all that huge to make the runoff. And then if you can make an argument that you're the one who's going to bring crime down and so on, you might be able to win a general election. I don't know. I was kind of surprised in retrospect how well Kim Fox did, the state's attorney, when she was running against Pat O'Brien. In 2020, and the whole Jussie Smollett scandal was percolating, and it looked like people were very frustrated with Kim Fox, and she clobbered O'Brien, who was running on a real law and order, lock him up message. And so I don't know. And that was countywide. I don't know that message has much purchase in the city, but we'll see, I guess. But again, with Quinn, I personally like Pat Quinn. I think his heart's in the right place.
Yeah, me too.
He wasn't a great governor, and it seems like he's always striving to have more power than maybe he ought to have. But anyway, we'll see what he says. Maybe he's going to be announcing a petition drive to do something. It could be.
Austin, why don't you describe the Lori Lightfoot campaign ad that you were talking about before we went live on the podcast here, the cringeworthy podcast.
Cold open, two guys sitting on a couch. One guy says to the other guy something pithy that I forget what they say. The other guy says
Lightfoot delivers? What about crime? That's what he says. I have a script in front of me here.
Wait, that's how the thing opens?
Guys.
But the opening line isn't that, is it, Eric?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Austin, keep going.
Yeah. Eric, do you have the rest of the script?
I do. You want to read it? Then the other guy says, line. The other guy says, people don't know she's delivering record spending for violence reduction. Not she's delivering violence reduction, but she's delivering record spending.
That's the thing about this ad. I'm like, what does this stuff even mean? It seems so mealy-mouthy, things they're using to extol her virtues. I don't even think it's a strong...
No, well, this is getting guns off the street. More money for police, says the other guy. You know, we didn't get into this mess overnight. The other guy says, true. And the second guy says, getting out of it takes time. And Lightfoot has a plan. Right now, somebody running for re-election...
Yeah,
I don't think and say it takes time. She's been mayor for 4 years, right? And then Lightfoot shows up. She's on the phone. She goes, I couldn't have said it better myself. And then the guy says, you want to play, officer, video game controller? She says, I'd love to, but I've got work to do for our city.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's not the pizza one.
No,
there
do
is
the
a one
pizza
where she
one.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot launches a plan creating thousands.
Has Lightfoot done anything?
Given the mess she was dealt, Lori's delivering. Chicago's number one for corporate expansion and ranked best American city. She even got 5,000 new Google jobs. And she was cool during COVID.
Hey. there are thousands of new jobs and a pepperoni.
Told you she delivers.
The pizza one is cold open, two guys on the couch watching TV. He opens his shirt and reveals a novelty T-shirt of, I think it might be a picture of her in that Halloween costume that was like, or maybe it was the cardboard cutout stand-up thing that you were seeing places where she was kind of peeking out.
Remember that.
Looking at you. And then she arrives at the door with a pepperoni pizza.
She delivers. Yeah. Delivers. So there's two ads. That's the delivers ad. And then the other one is delivers again. But I thought they were kind of intentionally hokey. Like it's for a sure. wink. So that works. But it wasn't working for you, was it, Austin?
Given the struggles that we're facing in Chicago right now, it just seems to strike a tone that isn't that's inauthentic. Like no one's kind of waiting for like a nod and a wink from the mayor. People want like some leadership from the mayor. And I don't think that's going to come in the form of like fun memes about the census cowboy or the Halloween costumes that they were doing during COVID. Like there's really serious problems. And maybe their calculation is, hey, this is all going to be a doom and gloom mayoral election. People don't want to hear about that. People want a positive vision for the future and they kind of want some like fun stuff. So we're going to go with that. That's like the Lightfoot campaign. Here's the problem with that though. She's not like that.
I was just going to say.
And no one thinks that she's like that.
She hasn't created her own public persona as not a likable person, as a kind of a angry, goes off half-cocked, kind of a bully of a person who in her personal correspondence, which was revealed, you know, through emails, has been really rude and obnoxious to people. And while not getting a whole lot done and complaining about other people, I think you know she did really well last time because she was the reform vote, and she's not going to be the reform vote this time. And the way for her to win re-election, I think, would have been to make sure that she wasn't running the whole Chicago. The way you win elections in Chicago, you don't win them on election day. You win them on the filing day. You win it when people don't run against you. And she's in a position now where she's got two, what I view as strong candidates running against her, Garcia because of his name recognition, and Johnson because of, you know, all that union backing. The interesting thing about Garcia, Chuy Garcia, is that he would have been the strongest challenger to Rahm if he'd sought another term. And then suddenly, in a very mysterious way, Luis Gutierrez drops out of the Congress and opens up a seat for Garcia to go there instead of running against Rahm. I mean, Rahm ended up not running because, for obvious, you know, because he wasn't going to win. But I don't know if we'll ever find out exactly why Gutierrez left the Congress so quickly to open up a spot for Garcia, so that Garcia didn't run against Emmanuel.
Are you insinuating something? What's the suggestion?
I just have a lot of questions that aren't answered. But I think that was a perfect example of a smart politician eliminating the competition instead of beating the competition.
Well, one of the things I remember is certainly when Richie Daley, Richard M. Daley, would run against like Doc Walls. There would be like one or two people running against him. It was just like, you know, a complete token candidates who are never going to win, and the elections were never even interesting. You know, you're absolutely right that this election is going to have some formidable candidates in it, and we don't know how many, but Lightfoot has certainly invited a lot of challenges. I did want to point out there is a third ad where the mayor says that she claims that our economy is the best in the country. And I will leave that to Austin to fact check that. And she says, I'm not going to sit here and tell you we did everything perfectly. We haven't. We've tried our darndest to make sure we got it right. And when we haven't, you pick yourself up, you listen, and you're humble. Mayor Lori Lightfoot says you're humble and you learn from your mistakes. It reminded me of Rahm Emanuel's sweater ad where he put on a sweater and said, you know, that's on me. I didn't listen so well. And I think that if Lightfoot is going to win, she ought to lean into this tough, almost nasty personality that she has and claim that that's getting things done. Because I don't think anyone's going to believe Lori Lightfoot is a nice, genial person who's in your kitchen and bringing you pizza and being humble. Gosh, you know, that's not Lori Lightfoot. That's way off brand for her.
I think you're totally right that, you know, her advisors ought to just lean into the, you know, kind of the badass persona, because that's authentic. And, you know, and she is combative. And some people like that. I just think that she's burned so many bridges, and she's kind of she's just given away goodwill. You know, yeah. In some ways, it reminded me of the Carol Moseley Braun thing from a couple decades ago, where somebody rode into power with so much public sentiment in their favor, and just by poor behavior and failing to do good politics, just lost it all. Just lost so much goodwill.
Didn't Lori Lightfoot have a statement or an ad that said something like, "I'm that way because I care"? You know, I'm surly, or I'm short with people just because I'm so passionate about this city. That would work for me.
Yeah, I think that was her. I think that was her campaign announcement video where she said that. As I remember.
That's a storyline that actually at least is credible.
Yeah, right. I would buy that. Then you don't have to be nice because you care. Right. Amendment 1 seems poised to pass. AP is calling it, but our colleague here, Austin Berg of the Illinois Policy Institute, says it hasn't been certified, so we shouldn't count the nays out yet. But it's not looking good for your team on this one, Austin.
No, it's definitely on the track to passage. But so people keep asking, like, "You guys going to concede? Why aren't you conceding?" And it's like, this isn't a peaceful transition of power situation. It's the Constitution. The ballot gets certified on December 5th. That will be the certified election results, and then that will be in the Constitution. And this is a taxpayer interest question. I'm not running someone's, you know, political campaign. So right now, what we do know is it can pass in two ways. One way is that it gets 60% of the people voting yes on the question. It didn't hit that. But it could win. And right now, as the way the votes are reported, looks like it could win on the simple majority threshold, the simple majority of all voters voting in the election. The variable that comes into play there that's very important is the drop-off rate, people who voted in the election but didn't vote on the question. And that's something that I really think responsible people should wait until the election results are actually certified to see where that shakes out.
I get that really, but if matters. They're extrapolating from the votes we already have and they see if it continues in this path, you're not going to win. What would be different about the yet unaccounted for ballots, Austin? How would it change?
Simple answer is we don't know, because we haven't had a constitutional amendment like this in Illinois that's been so close on this threshold. And at least I can't think of one in Illinois history. So the result doesn't change if you call it now versus when the results are certified. So I just think it's irresponsible. Like, there's no reason to do that just yet. There could be something where, for instance, the counting of the ballots that don't have that question filled are like backloaded in terms of the counting. Like, we just don't know. It's kind of a black box. So that's the reason.
Austin, you should just claim it's a fraudulent election. It's fake. It's been stolen.
And never over.
That would be the easy thing to do. That would be definitely the easy thing to do. And we're trying to be fair.
I have a question about this. I know that one of the provisions of the amendment had to do with the inability of the General Assembly to pass by some sort of straight vote any kind of right to work, so-called right to work laws. I call them right to freeload laws. But this governs private unions. Does federal law in any way trump that, so to speak? Is that something does this amendment apply to private employers and private unions? I was reading that over, thinking like, how does that work?
Exactly? So the amendment basically does three things. It grants new rights to collective bargaining over a thing called economic welfare that is broad and totally undefined, and safety, which is quite broad and undefined in the Constitution. So that's beyond wages, benefits, and working conditions. These are two new terms that are in collective bargaining. We argue that that can't apply to the private sector because federal law governs private sector bargaining through the National Labor Relations Act. So those are new bargaining powers only for the government sector. The second thing it does is it says lawmakers can't pass a law that infringes on those collective bargaining rights. So this is going to come into play in public safety in a big way. And I think this is where a lot of the left got completely duped on this question. If you care about criminal justice reform, if you care about policing reform, if you think the Safety Act is a good idea, you should not have voted yes on this amendment. Because police unions are going to be able to bargain with their employer, and with the results of that bargaining are going to trump state law. You can pass whatever state law you want in terms of discipline, whatever. A police union can say, no, this is related to economic welfare. This is related to safety. You cannot pass a law that infringes on my scope of collective bargaining. So that there's going to be many unintended consequences of this if it does pass. That's one of them. And the third provision is related to right to work. So there are 27, 28 states in the country where you cannot be fired if you refuse to pay money to a union in the private sector. That's a right to work law. Illinois is not a right to work state. What this says is we're going to have a right to work ban in the Constitution that only affects the private sector. For government workers across the nation, because of a Supreme Court case called Janus v. AFSCME, every government worker has the right to not pay a union. So they do not have to pay a union as a condition of government.
But they still enjoy the union benefits. They still get the same deal.
The important thing, though, to note with that is that what Eric calls freeloading, saying someone not paying a union because they disagree with what the union does, but they're still covered by the contract that is bargained for by the union. That's because of laws that mandate exclusive representation. Those are laws that unions bargain for in Springfield and in other state capitals that say, no, we need to be exclusive representatives at this workplace. We cannot have competing unions. So that, to me, that's a disingenuous argument when unions make it, because they're lobbying for the power for exclusive representation at a workplace.
What's the better course? Should people be allowed to freeload, as Eric said? That is, if I don't want to pay the dues, I shouldn't have to pay the dues. I still should be able to work there. Or should I have to pay the dues?
I think you should have competition, really. So like people should be able to join any kind of bargaining unit they want or bargain themselves at a workplace. But I have a real problem with, especially in the government sector, people being forced to pay a union as a condition of their employment. Because the fact is, those unions, especially look at the CTU, it's highly political. Only 20% of every dollar that goes to the CTU from dues goes to representing teachers. The other 80% goes to other programs, administrative costs, politics, overhead. These are large political machines.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have compulsory dues in that kind of environment, I think they're not accountable to rank and file workers.
Well, I will say this. I did interview some union people about the idea of wouldn't you want a law that would say, okay, if you're not going to join the union, then you're not covered by the collective bargaining agreement. You're not covered by the wages. You can go ahead and cut your own deal with management. And unions really are opposed to that as well. They really don't like the idea of someone who, you know, even if you could say, well, look, okay, I won't take the raise that the union bargained for. I don't want to be part of the union. I don't want to be covered by that deal. The union wants you to be able to freeload on that. I mean, as I put it, they don't want to cut people loose. So it's a conundrum. But I guess my question is, I know that Janus v. AFSCME only covered public employee unions. Is there a chance at some point that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, would say that right to work that it is mandatory to allow all unionized workers that right not to be in a union? Is it doesn't seem out of the question, especially with the makeup of the court we've got right now.
I'm not as familiar with that. My sense is no, that was going to end up being a states' rights thing. My colleague Miley Smith, who I think is the best sort of labor mind in our state, would definitely know the answer to that. But that's like to Eric's earlier point. It's sort of this idea of, well, it's a deal so good we have to force you to pay for it. And that is where that's where they totally lose me on this kind of a thing. And I totally get the importance of unions for workplace safety and their historic role in the United States. But the reality is a lot of people don't feel well represented by their union. And I don't think it's fair to force them to pay for it.
I'm still confused with I'm still just kind of struck by how easy it was relatively to amend the Constitution of the state of Illinois. Because I think we're all clamoring for we should have a constitutional convention or constitutional changes at the federal level or the state level, and it never seems to happen. If all we got to do is persuade 50% of the people that voted or 60% of the people that voted on an issue and get a lot of money behind it or find a clever way to word it, then why can't we change the state pension system so that, as you've said in the past, Austin, it doesn't affect the people that got the good deal, but we don't have to keep rolling it out to our detriment. Why can't we do that? And I'm still not sure that people understood Amendment 1 enough to cast credible, I don't know what other word to use, you know, informed votes on that. You know, to me, what you got with Amendment 1 was fixing something that wasn't broken anyway.
Well, we certainly are nowhere close to passing right-to-work laws in Illinois, given the supermajorities that the Democrats have in both chambers of the House. You know, and my reservation about this was, as Austin pointed out, we don't know what a lot of these fairly vague terms might mean and how many, what's going to happen with the court fights having to do mm-hmm. with them. Mm-hmm. And there was no reason why a lot of these things couldn't just be made laws rather than constitutional amendments, because when the playing field changes, when the national mood changes, when the economy changes, I think you want to give your legislature a little bit more wiggle room for, say, tweaking them. I mean, I've mentioned this before, the Safety Act. There are certainly aspects of the Safety Act that just about everybody agrees need to be clarified. And you can't clarify a constitutional amendment without going through this incredible process again. And otherwise, you're going to be stuck in endless court fights. So, I was torn on this amendment myself also.
And they haven't changed the Safety Act that much. The special session is underway now, and I haven't heard them say they're going to change it in significant ways, more procedural ways. You know, is it possible that the reason that 100 out of 102 or 102 out of 104 states' attorneys didn't like the Safety Act was because they and the judges are going to have to work harder on the disposition of the people that go into the court? Those people that need to stay in jail can stay in jail. You've just now got to make your case. They've got to work a little harder. I wonder if that was one of the reasons it had such opposition by all the county attorneys in Illinois.
Well, the more suspects you let out, the bigger chance that one of them will do something terrible and you'll be criticized for it.
So don't let them out. Say you're a flight risk or harm to somebody else.
Exactly. It's as simple as, I mean, the simplest thing to do is to just put them in jail and leave them there. And so I can see why that many, you know, prosecutors, you know, went in that way. I mean, it's just the safer way to go. And they get criticized, judges get criticized, you know, when something bad happens. And ultimately something bad does happen, because if you're letting thousands of people out of jail, you know, on bail, one of them's going to do something. That's just human nature.
And of course, it's already happening, right, Mark?
Yes.
It's happening all the time. And so the idea that cash bail is behind us. I mean, right now, if you have enough money, you can buy your way out of jail. And
exactly. And see, that argument, Eric, didn't get made enough, I don't think. I mean, it was people tried, but, you know, the whole Darren Bailey side of this whole, you know, equation was really pounding the Safety Act as a terrible thing that was just going to let, you know, criminals run wild. And nobody was saying enough that, you know, some shoplifter is in jail for, you know, 2 months while some embezzler of $1 million gets out that afternoon. And, you know, it was a social justice issue. And that they should have been proud to push it as a social justice issue. And what's going to happen, I think, as far as changes, I think we're going to have to see what actually happens and how it actually, when the law takes effect, we're going to have to see kind of how it's implemented. And I think that's why I think they don't want to fix it yet, because it hasn't even gone into effect yet.
And I think there's some questions about exactly what the standards are for holding someone in jail. And it seems to me like some of the standards are fairly unreasonable. Like, you have to be able to prove to a judge that someone is actually a flight risk. And they may end up tweaking some of those so that it's not quite as hard to hold somebody who has, for instance, skipped bail or skipped release other times before, that you can hold that history against them. There are aspects of this that seem troubling. And I don't know how strong or how deep the objection of these 100 out of 102 states attorneys across Illinois were. They may have been isolated small points. They felt like this isn't right, this needs to be fixed, or they may be wholesale objections. I haven't really read much about
that. Well, that's funny. Has anybody interviewed all 100 of them and said, who asked you and what was your objection, and then make a grid or something? Because it's only been the one side that's been reminding us of that, and you know, they've got skin in the game. I don't know how real that number is.
Some of them are, I mean, I've seen interviews. Ben Bradley, I think, actually recently did a good interview with one state's attorney who was for it. I believe the Lake County state's attorney, and then another Collar County state's attorney who was against it. And at least the woman he interviewed who was against it had some very reasonable concerns. And I think was very much not of the mind that, okay, we need to throw out this entire thing and repeal it and start over again. It was just some real necessary changes. And I think the legitimate criticism of it has always been, today judges can hold someone without bail. not everybody can buy their way out of jail. But the standards by which now you must prove someone is a risk are too high and will let out too many actual dangerous people. And that really seems to be at the heart of the debate and something that should be addressed.
And it seems debatable, right? I mean, you know, just on a surface, it seems like that's something that ought to be really looked at carefully. And maybe Mark's right that we have to wait until this thing actually goes into effect. But then once it does and we need to tweak it, the General Assembly will be able to tweak it, have the power to tweak it pretty easily without having to go through a whole constitutional amendment process. It's a moving target. Safety Act is a moving target. And I think you're right. It's poorly understood. Darren Bailey just kept saying he was going to get rid of the whole thing. And there's a lot of good stuff in the Safety Act. I'm interested to see what they do in the veto session, see if they figure out what they need to do to mollify at least some of these state's attorneys. I'd be curious to see what happens with that. Maybe a radio show, radio host could have a state's attorney on to talk about
that. Have 100 state's attorneys on the line at the same time.
We interviewed Jim Glasgow, the Will County state's attorney, about it. And boy, he was featured in the Bailey campaign ads just saying the jails are going to open and they're all going to go running. They're just going to go running, committing crimes left and right.
He's ostensibly a Democrat, too.
And I interviewed him years ago. We were doing stories on drug courts, so alternative sentencing for people with addiction, so they wouldn't have to go to prison. They could do some kind of service and treatment program. And Will County was one of the real leaders in that sort of program statewide. And Glasgow, it was effective because Glasgow looks the part of a state's attorney. He's got this, slick back silver hair, the pinstripe suits. He was the Drew Peterson case. Like, he's a tough on crime sort of prosecutor. And he was able to create a really cool program, drug court program in Will County that has had a lot of success.
I just don't buy but I don't believe that they believe that January 1st, we're going to have to let these people go. I just don't believe that's going to happen. He got kind of ticked off when I said that, but I just don't believe it. That just, on earth, that just doesn't make sense to me. Speaking of Taylor Swift, she's going to do 3 shows at Soldier Field next June. Tickets go on sale for everyone tomorrow, and the prices and the pressure to get them are through the roof. With fees on the secondary market, some pairs are listed at $34,000. I asked our listeners if that's fair or wrong, and according to my highly non-scientific news click, 94% said that that's just wrong. I think it's kind of both. Nobody's being denied a vote here. You know, it's the greatest harm is that your kid doesn't get to see Taylor Swift when she's in town because you don't have thousands of dollars and somebody else does. I talked to a guy who wrote a book called Ticketmasters about ticketing and what's happened over the last few decades. It's fascinating. He doesn't think anybody's going to get $34,000. It's kind of like their asking price, but it'll come down. He says, never buy the tickets right now. Wait, 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 wait.
Well, I have an unpopular view of this, which is that I think that performers ought to be able to charge dynamic prices, that they should be making the money off their own popularity. And that if Taylor Swift and her people can charge $500 a ticket, whatever they want to charge, they should be able to do that and people shouldn't complain about it. So that's my take on it, which is at this kind of level, I'm sort of all about the free market when it comes to concerts.
Yeah, but Ticketmaster has a virtual monopoly, so there's not a bunch of free market going on there. I mean, people need to look at that. I mean, on the general basic point, I agree with Eric that it's just a supply and demand thing, and if people are willing to spend gigantic amounts of money to hear someone perform, so be it. I get that part, but all these fees they lay on and all these extra costs, it seems like Ticketmaster needs looking into.
My biggest concern was the fact that this was trending higher than Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, losing billions of dollars in what may be the biggest fraud case in the last 20 years since Enron in America, and missiles hitting Poland. So that was concerning, but I generally agree with these two guys. I think the most I've ever paid for a ticket was dynamically priced, or maybe it was just secondary market to see Bruce Springsteen, who is, like now on the ahead of the curve on all this stuff on mm-hmm. Broadway. He had a one-man show on Broadway.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was like $1,500 or something. And it's the most I'll ever pay on something. And it was the best show I've ever seen.
Was that for two or for one?
It was worth it. I think it was just me. Yeah.
Put it this way. Did he give you $1,500 worth of entertainment?
Absolutely. Oh. Yeah. And I got a free cup.
You know, everybody's talking about, well, what I paid to see the Eagles in 1977, it was like $9, and that's $56 today. And I'm like, okay, now it's not the teenagers trying to figure out, or the young people, or whoever goes to a Taylor Swift concert. It's their parents and grandparents are, A, trying to get through on their phones. Everybody's walking around this building today with their phones in their hand, you know, waiting. They're in some sort of virtual queue. And then, God forbid, you do get a chance to buy a ticket, maybe in the secondary market. You know, what's your line? Where do you tell the kid, now we're not going to get the tickets?
This is actually one. So people talk about, like, speaking of Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, a lot of people, rightfully so in a lot of cases, think NFTs and crypto stuff is all a big scam. This is one instance where it makes sense as a new technology, because artists can issue NFTs as tickets. And then when those are resold, they get a cut of that. So it's like an asset that stays in custodian of the artist the whole way. That's an interesting application of that technology, I think. Now, I don't know if that's being done now, but
I don't know what you just said, Austin.
So instead of Ticketmaster being the middleman, I'm Taylor Swift, and I have a ticket that I give to you, and encoded in the ticket is code that if you sell it to somebody else, I get a cut of that secondary market sale. So it's not just, you know, going on eBay or some other, you know, StubHub or something. It is in my custody, really, as the artist, and I make a little percent every time it's resold.
But that NFT only has value for that one concert ticket then, right?
Right. It's a ticket. Yeah.
But how does Taylor Swift know what the ticket's sold for? If you're selling it to me, Austin, and I write you a check for $5,000 because I really want to see Taylor Swift.
And you wrote a check, but keep going.
A check. Right. I Venmo'd you. I don't know. However we transfer money these days. I mean, I guess I don't understand how that. I am among those who think the whole NFT thing is a huge scam. But
yeah, I've always thought that it was nothing. It's code, isn't it, Austin? An NFT.
Right, but what's a ticket these days? It's just code.
Sure, but at least that's something. Okay, but that gains you access to a concert. A lot of the NFTs.
Right, so does this. That's all I'm saying.
No, but I mean the NFTs that we previously talked about for all kinds of stuff, you don't actually have anything. You don't even retain the rights to the Michael Jordan jump shot. You just have the NFT of the jump shot. And so you can tell people you own Michael Jordan's jump shot, but I can still download it. I can still watch it. I can still buy the sneaker. Michael Jordan can still trade on it. So I've never understood what the value is other than bragging rights. At least in this case, it gains you access to a show. That would make sense to me. I went to the show. And I still don't know what I'm talking about. Okay. Well, I think on that, we'll wrap it up. Any last thoughts from any of you smart guys? Eric, anything else you want to push out there before we wrap this one up?
Well, I just think it's a reminder that the election deniers and the berserk people and the crazy people lost last Tuesday's election, and that for the Republican Party to try to follow Donald Trump into the future is just insane. I think the message that the American people were sending last week is fairly clear at this point, which is that they are tired of people griping about the 2020 election, and they're looking to the future, and the future ought not include Donald Trump. That's my closing thought.
Well, I'm going to say that what I'm worried about is that the news media are going to start normalizing the MAGA Republicans who are not as far, you know, to the right as Donald Trump, that they're gonna pretend that people like Ron DeSantis are centrists simply because they're not Donald Trump. And I think that'd be a big mistake.
Do you have any, but you would rather have DeSantis on the ticket than Trump, wouldn't you?
No.
Well,
no,
put it this way.
I think they're both fascists, and I don't want either one of them.
Yeah, I get that, but I also think that Trump is more dangerous because he's more charismatic. I know you wouldn't want either of them as president, but if you had to pick one of them, don't you think Trump is more dangerous than DeSantis?
Just because of his mysterious charisma somehow,
yeah, or whatever.
His ability to achieve like a cult following.
Yes.
Maybe I don't know whether that would translate to DeSantis. In some ways, DeSantis is sneakier and more efficient. So no, I'm more scared of DeSantis than Trump.
What do you think in there, Austin, as we close today's pod?
I'm thinking of that National Review story that just said no. That's what my head is. Just no.
Brief.
It stinks.
Concise.
It's going to be a hard 2 years. It's going to be really good for CNN and really bad for everybody else.
All Picayune Sentinel subscribers, all you have to do is click on the link to that editorial in tomorrow's edition.
And that wraps it up. That's Eric Zorn, Mark Jacob, and Austin Berg. I'm John Williams. Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman produced this podcast. Thanks again, guys. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
That was fun. That was great, guys.
Mark, I hope you're having fun because you're dynamite on this, and I would sure like to include you in our little group more often if you didn't mind.
No, I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And you know, you guys have such interesting things to say. And you tolerate me being quiet on stuff I know nothing about. Because Amendment number one, I voted on it. And I think I understood enough. But boy, I was not strong on it. I didn't quite understand. And Taylor Swift tickets, I'm not buying them. So I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, Austin makes a good point that of all the important things in the world, that's not one of them. But it doesn't mean that people aren't paying attention to it. I'm always impressed with Austin's patience, too. Austin just sits there and listens and listens and listens. And I'm thinking, he's got some shit on this, and he is waiting his turn patiently. Are you in all of your interactions with people, Austin, as patient as you are on this podcast?
Yeah, it makes my wife insane.
I was going to really say,
don't.
It's like
I don't. Emote.
Well, my wife always says that people think I agree with them when I don't, and I'm saying, well, I'm not going to argue with people like in social situations all the time. She says, well, if you don't say that you disagree, they'll think you agree with them.
Yeah, and, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been so my whole. I went to college, at, you know, super duper liberal college. So all my friends are super progressive, and I'm a kooky libertarian. So. I usually am pretty quiet, but then when something that I need to be animated and really fired up about happens, my wife will be like, "What? Why aren't you as fired up about this as me?" And I that's not how I am.
Why weren't you this much fun at my mom's house at Christmas?
Yeah,
or something
yeah,
like
exactly.
that. Yeah. All right, guys. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you. Take care.
Nice to see you.
Adios.
See you. Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.